This is Voices of Our World. I'm your host, Eileen Bott. Suck it up. Walk it off. Get over it. That's the training. That's the message. Stow it, soldier. Military culture is semper fi, kill or be killed. As occupying force, trust no one. Every object is an IED. Every person, even a child walking toward you, is a potential bomber. 14 daily insurgent attacks in 2004. In 2005, it was 70 a day. In 2006, we're up to 90. Then after months of unrelenting heat, dust storms, sun glare, constant firefights, ducking snipers, and hoping for an otherworldly letter from home, you're done. And return home to a place where the nightly crickets will never be able to compete with the noises in your head. How do we reward and decompress our returning sons and daughters? The American Medical Association uses the term battle mind to describe mental changes most veterans experience to some degree. Increased bouts with confusion, tension, hypervigilance, shortened attention span, and impaired memory. The Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, reports that 1 in 5 returning troops will experience PTSD symptoms, and 1 in 3 will seek help this year. But when they do, they're often told their first available appointment for psychological assessment and counseling is months away. And when they ask why that's the case, they're told too many of them are requesting services all at once. Buried in Section 9528 of the No Child Left Behind Act of 2002 is the requirement that all public and private high schools receiving federal funds must provide access to students' names, addresses, and phone numbers to military recruiters. But are our military leaders as insistent about thanking our troops with the best aftercare as they are with recruitment? Now back to our conversation with Penny Coleman.
One of the things that I really would like to talk about is the drugs, because it's so unbelievably outrageous. In Vietnam, soldiers were using a lot of marijuana and then heroin after Nixon's war on drugs made marijuana so hard to get, to self-medicate, to, you know, just dull what was going on in their heads. But in Vietnam, for the first time, the military also made use of tranquilizers and anti-anxiety drugs. Those drugs, in the short run, if what you're looking for are boots on the ground, the moral equivalent of giving a soldier a local anesthetic for a gunshot wound and sending him back into combat. When you give those kinds of drugs to somebody while they're still undergoing the stressor, it interrupts the development of normal coping mechanisms, and the long-term effects of the trauma are much worse. So I don't know what the doctors in Vietnam thought they were doing, what they thought the long-term effects of the drugs would be. But the doctors in Iraq now who are giving antidepressants to soldiers with no supervision at all, these drugs are commonly known to come with warning labels about side effects that include suicide. And when they give those drugs to kids who are still experiencing stress reactions in a combat zone, it's just playing roulette with their lives. In May, the Hartford Courant ran a series of articles exposing what is a common practice in this army of deploying soldiers who have serious documented mental health histories, I mean, including bipolarity and autism. And these kids are asked on their pre-deployment health forms to check a box if they have had any health issues in the past year. This is a career army, so these kids, when they're recruited, they actually want to go into the military, so only 3% of them are checking this box. Of the 3% who checked the box, 1 in 300 was given any follow-up whatsoever by the Army. And some of them were on antidepressants when they were recruited. Some of them were given antidepressants when they attempted or explicitly threatened suicide. And I think you can make excuses for the ways that those prescribed drugs made coming home harder for Vietnam vets, but not for this generation of soldiers. They know exactly what that's going to do. Post-traumatic stress often leads to suicide. Post-combat, post-traumatic stress, and suicide, there is a causative relationship whether or not the military has done the studies or not, and I believe that's true. And I think they've been able to get away with camouflaging what amounts to a virtual epidemic of death since Vietnam. you know, one of the claims that I made in the book is a claim that I repeat from, you know, very, very conservative sources like the Oxford Companion to American Military History, which says flat out that there are more Vietnam veterans who have killed themselves than there are names on the wall. You know, I didn't make it up. I first heard it on mainstream media sources like 60 Minutes, Discover Magazine, CBS News. And there were a lot of independent scientific studies that were coming out in the 80s that were coming up with similar findings. The government has, and the VA and the military have never stopped getting really upset about it. They, whenever anybody repeats it, they say it's irresponsible and it's sensationalist. But in 1990, they did what they claimed was the biggest mental health study that had ever been done, the National Vietnam Veterans Readjustment Study. And that study never mentioned suicide at all, in spite of the fact that suicide was central to all of the studies that preceded it and provoked it, and all of those news stories that were coming out. Is it an oversight? I have entirely credible sources, including Jonathan Shea, who wrote the foreword for the book, who completely agree with my claim. And I don't have scientific evidence, but neither do they. I really want them to do those studies. They're the ones with access to the money and the service records. I can't come up with money, service records, or a more logical explanation for the decades of denial.
Now, it would be very possible, because many of these suicides would be performed with, pardon me, a gun or with medication, that kind of thing. It's going to be very, very possible for anybody with an agenda to structure a study such that we never have a real hard number on who did commit suicide.
Suicide statistics are really hard to come by anyway. There's such a taboo against mental illness in our culture. And there have been insurance issues, and there were VA issues having to do with suicides. One of the stories in the book is the story of a daughter whose father killed himself, and the VA essentially wrote her and her family off. And that was unconscionable. But a lot of people are afraid to admit that somebody that they love or care about was a suicide. There's a shame attached to it.
If you're just joining us, this is Voices of Our World, and we're speaking with the author of Flashback, Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, Suicide, and the Lessons of War, Penny Coleman.
And it's also very hard to determine in a lot of cases whether or not a death is a suicide, unless there's a suicide note. But, so I think it is very hard to come up with statistics that are reliable.
I'd have trouble trusting the military to do anything appropriate to help these kids if we actually are making them pay for turned-in equipment when they're leaving the service because it has a bullet hole in it or a rip or a tear. There's lots of documented stories of kids who've been, as they're being released from the service, they have to pay money back to the military for equipment that was given to them, but they're now turning it in and it's got a blood stain on it. And these would be the same people I'm going to trust to help the kids that come home with wounds in their hearts and their souls and their brains?
When this administration came in, the guy who was the head of the VA when we went into Iraq said, "We're going to need some more money." And instead of giving him the money, they fired him. And they brought in another one of those breathtakingly inappropriate appointees. This guy is a real estate developer. His credentials include being head of the Republican National Committee, ambassador to the Vatican. He has no health care experience at all and no shame when it comes to submitting ridiculously inadequate budgets. So last year, there were 50,000 veterans waiting for an appointment to see a doctor. The individual therapy, as I said before, is just a thing of the past. And the waiting lists for the PTSD groups are long, and people aren't getting in time to have their illnesses treated. But he's trying to make up for the shortfall in their budgets with these tricks that just take your breath away. He tried charging soldiers and veterans at Walter Reed last year for their lunches, and Congress slapped his wrist and said, you can't do that. It's really bad PR. And so his next little game was he decided that he was going to have the 72,100% disabled veterans go through a recertification process. These are the most fragile of these veterans. And Congress made him take that back, too. But not until some kid had killed himself with his recertification papers on his chest. I mean, they are shameless. They really are.
Penny, when all is said and done, you and I have both been at a red light and looking at a yellow bumper sticker that says support our troops. What would real support for our troops, for these wounded and scarred young men and women coming home, what would real support be?
I think that one of the ways that veterans can be helped to come home is for them to be given the kinds of evaluations that take seriously what kinds of symptoms they're experiencing. I think that they need to have really quick intervention when those symptoms start to appear. Because if they get the drug and other therapies that are available that have been shown to be helpful with post-traumatic stress injuries, if they can be taught the kinds of learning techniques that make life more manageable and more feasible, they're far less likely to experience this illness as a chronic life disruptor. But, you know, the truth is that this is all about young men and women who are going to suffer the effects of their combat experience for the rest of their lives, every day. And they aren't going to wake up someday, assuming they were able to sleep the night before and not have memories and nightmares and flashbacks. They're going to be hypervigilant. They're going to have startle responses that are often violent and inappropriate. They're going to have trouble managing their anger and their relationships. So many relationships fall apart for the rest of their lives. And they're going to continue to abuse substances to help them forget what they've lived for. And I think that if we decide that we're going to take care of them, whatever wounds that they come home with, whether they're mental or physical, it's going to be incredibly expensive. But if we decide that we're not going to, I think the price is higher even still. But that's the conversation that I think we should be having.
Is our government providing our soldiers with enough and the right kind of support? Email us at radio@maryknoll.org or go to our website, www.voicesofourworld.org. Just click on Contact Us, or you can call us at 877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 877-MARYKNOLL. Well, that's all for this week, and thanks for listening. Penny Coleman is just one of the voices of our world. I'm your host, Eileen Bott. And this week's show was produced by Kathy Golden. You heard music today by David Rovics and Amer Diab. Our website is www.voicesofourworld.org, where you can listen, learn more about today's guests and topics, answer our weekly question, or subscribe to our podcast. Go to www.voicesofourworld.org. To learn more about Mary Knoll or try Mary Knoll magazine in English or Spanish, please call 877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 877-MARYKNOLL. And please join us next time for more Voices of Our World.